This is the Into Show. Listen in as we get into details and sometimes in too deep. Happy New Year. I mean, it's already been a month into 2022, but this is the first episode for the year. I can't believe it's taken me this long to sit down and record. I've had tabs open on my desktop for the longest time, so it'll be great to now get this underway. With the new year brings New Year's resolutions. So many of them are health-based, how to be more fit, lose weight, get in shape, be healthier. And one big hot topic is diets. So we're going to get into diet details. Now, when you're looking at the history of food, unsurprisingly, a lot of it started in France, with the grande cuisine, that when you hear chefs having been trained traditionally, they are trained in the French manner. That is what is entailed in that mode of learning. The biggest factors impacting diets and food trends is abundance and migration. Cooking was initially like fancy cooking and pastries and sweets. These sort of things were initially reserved for the aristocracy. They were the ones who had chefs. The public, the peasants, they ate whatever they could to survive. And so these exotic foods were all reserved for the elite. As abundance of food grew, there still wasn't a massive uptake of fancy dishes amongst the poorer populations, but this brought a lot of different experimentation. And then later, with migration and movement during war times and famines, it actually introduced a lot of new spices. In France specifically, a lot of the Middle Eastern migrants, they brought spices that the French had never seen. And this was sort of the start of food trends, because anyone who could get their hands on something exotic, this was, you know, the crème de la crème. It was seen as a massive show of wealth. And in a lot of old portraits, it's obvious, you know, the bodies of aristocracy are depicted as being more voluptuous and chubby, because that was another sign of wealth. Foreign fashion was something that kind of came in the 1700s, 1800s, lots of global discovery, and colonization and migration, trade, all of these sorts of things brought spices, flavors, new dishes. And this is where food trends kind of started to pick up. Sushi was seen as so exotic at first because it was raw fish. This wasn't typical of cooking. The whole point of cooking was to cook something and show your expertise in the way that you cook it, knowing the times, knowing the ingredients. So just having raw fish wrapped up in some rice, it was this really exotic foreign idea, and it was only accessible to those who could pay money for it. So these sorts of foods, particularly from Asia, they were seen as very top-notch. So that brought a lot of food trends. These food trends eventually developed into diets a lot in the 20th century. There were lots of these types of trends for health, and they were claiming to have nutritional benefit. This is sort of where you can start to draw a line between actual nutrition and food fashion. So every cycle of food fashion has observed a reverse snobism. So the snobism in food fashion entails those who can access and flaunt these fashionable foods. And reverse snobism is when enough people start to get sick of not having access to these food trends, so then they start to show off traditional dishes. So in France, this was something like when ratatouille became popular again. This is a peasant dish, and it became again a higher class dish because it was seen as, you know, that reverse snobism, which eventually took over as snobism, and so the cycle continues. With diets throughout the 20th century, it becomes a lot more interesting. So the sort of first nutritional health-based diet was John Hopkins' diet, which basically talks about a calorie deficit. You want less input than output, so you're burning excess fats. Now, in the 90s, it was a massive, massive trend also because of body image changes and a lot of fashion magazines, supermodels being super, super skinny. The whole look of losing weight and being that skinny meant that a lot of women particularly were using a lot of these diets. And the actual, if you look at the cost of Friends, they were sort of idealized as the pinnacle body image of the time. And the actual diets that they ate were in such a caloric deficit that it was of a massive health concern. And I'll give a little bit more detail in a second, but they, all three girls, actually ate the exact same salad every single day for 10 years. Now, that's insane to me. I can barely have the same breakfast 2 days in a row, let alone the same lunch, which I think is my favorite meal of the day, every single day for 10 years. Like, just take that in for a second. This salad, it was called the Jen salad because apparently it was sort of initiated by Jennifer Aniston. It was, had some sort of grain, some kind of like barley, lentil, chickpeas, spinach, I think broccoli, a few other little flavors. But it sounds like a relatively nice salad. Good enough to eat every single day for 10 years? Questionable. So Lisa Kudrow did a podcast as well, and a few interviews, and one of the ones that I listened to, she was talking about how she was actually insecure next to Jen and Courtney because they were not just skinny, but they were also short. And Lisa was tall. I personally think she looked amazing. I consider her skinny. And she was talking about how she felt insecure. And mind you, Jennifer and Courtney also did smoke while Lisa didn't. And it is known that smoking does contribute to weight loss. But it's still amazing to me to think that she, Lisa Kudrow, was concerned about her body image. Now, it's also known that Courtney had issues with fertility. She talked about her issues with fertility. According to information that we have now, the caloric deficit that the girls were in actually is so unhealthy that it would have contributed and had some side effects in fertility issues. Not saying this is the cause of Courtney's issues, not confirming this at all, but it is just showing that nutrition has a massive impact on so many aspects of your life. And this food trend, this fad diet that wasn't healthy, it wasn't, like, it might have been healthy in terms of the food, but the whole caloric deficit was not healthy by any means. And you can kind of see some of those results. So that's the John Hopkins diet. It was a health concern. It was recommended for obesity, diabetes, people who actually need to not just control how much they're eating, but also what they're eating. And so a caloric approach was medically at the time, that was how it was sort of initiated. But there are other diets, for example, one of the most interesting ones, the keto diet. Now, this is known to be like very low to no carbs, high fat and high protein. It's actually not meant to be that high protein. Lots of people do have their variations with higher protein intake, but main focus is actually on fats. Now, this diet was developed for epilepsy. So it was actually in orphanages and in midwifery wings. It was given to children who were suffering from epilepsy because studies had shown that increase of fat can help with myelination in the brain, which improves electrical firing and helps with epileptic seizures and symptoms. So it's crazy to think now. You see, keto diet, I've actually tried the keto diet myself before. I found out this fact. And it's so interesting to think that this came from a treatment for epilepsy, which is now used as like weight loss sort of health benefit to get more energy. One of the caveats with the keto specifically and with a lot of diets that change how you're getting your energy, carbohydrates are the best way to get energy because you're getting glucose immediately broken down and it goes straight to the brain. It's how the body functions. But with these diets that have different forms of sort of different primary forms of energy. When you go into like ketosis, for example, yes, it is good. It can be beneficial for a short period of time, but that is the key trick. It should not be a long-term diet and a long-term solution to nutrition. So going now to a little bit more about nutrition, the most popular diets are vegetarian and vegan diets. I did a deep digging Google searching of the formal vegetarian definition and actually came across a myriad of different isms, vegetarianism, veganism, flexitarianisms. So I'm just going to explain that a little bit. The simplest definition of vegetarianism is a diet free of meat, fish, and fowl flesh. But there's also different variations. So lacto-ovo-vegetarians avoid animal flesh but eat eggs and milk products. Now, these are slightly different from vegans who forego eating and often wearing and using all animal-based products, and that often includes honey. Raw foodists are a subcategory of vegans who, rather than focusing on what they're omitting from their diet, they focus on mainly eating raw fruits, vegetables, legumes, sprouts, and nuts. This is also in line with a paleo diet, which has the same focus, but a paleo diet is the diet that raw foodists, which are a category of vegans, follow. Hope you're keeping up with me. The next category is pescatarians, who eat fish and seafood but not meat, and they usually aren't so concerned with animal products and honey and not using and using faux leather and stuff like that. And then again, to the lacto-ovo-vegetarian, there's a split. So you have lacto-vegetarians who eat dairy products but not eggs, and ovo-vegetarians who eat eggs but not dairy. And the last ones are the very extreme fruitarians who focus, again, not on what they're omitting, but on what they actually are eating, which are fruits, nuts, seeds, and plant food, but they tend to consume more fruit than vegetables. And the last one, flexitarians, are vegetarians who occasionally eat meat and fish. So that's a lot of differentiation. I think that when you go into this much detail, you know, it can be quite overwhelming, because maybe if you're looking to start a diet or you already follow one of these different food lifestyles, it can be very, you know, there's the umbrella statements of vegetarian and vegan, which kind of cover the majority of these. But it's interesting to know that there are actually differentiations, and there are probably some people who will be very pedantic to make sure that they are differentiated from just being a umbrella vegan. I personally, I'm just putting it out there, disclaimer, I love meat. I am a meat eater. I have great friends who are vegetarian, so this is not a commentary. It is a commentary. This is not a judgment. This is not saying what you should and shouldn't be doing. This is simply a commentary and insight into these different lifestyles. Because ultimately, you know, nutrition does play an important part in everyone's life. You know, you can't really live long by not eating, although this can be debated by some monks. But generally, the population, general populations don't live very long if they don't eat. So food is an important part, and different ways that you eat play an important part. Now, I personally, from what research I've done, from the knowledge base that I have, I think also when I say I'm a meat eater, I don't have meat every single day. I have meat every so often, probably not as scarcely as flexitarians, who are the vegetarians that eat meat and fish occasionally. But I think that idea of a flexitarian diet, you're not very strict on what you're cutting out, and that's the main thing, not cutting out everything, but it is sort of limiting the meat and fish consumption. Now, that kind of nicely leads on to reasons why people become vegetarians. a lot of people, they do it from personal choice because they have found in their experience that eating meats doesn't make them feel so good, and just naturally they have a vegetarian lifestyle. So even though they are more consciously completely avoiding different meats and fish, it is something that is easier for them to sustainably integrate into their life. So it's health reasons is one of them. One of my old friend's sisters, she's allergic to gluten, eggs, butter, certain berries, mango, kiwi, list goes on and on. So basically a vegan diet is a perfect option for her from, again, a health reason. And these are often people who have like looked with nutritionists or talked with their doctor about the sort of pros and cons of following such a diet for their particular body, for their allergies, and they have also worked probably with those professionals to see how they can substitute some of the nutrients that they are missing out on if they need them. Because often if they have an allergy to it, their body has a compensation for some of those nutrients. So that's in terms of health. Now, some of the things that I've seen in terms of health is not necessarily fixing a problem, but to improve an average, already relatively healthy person to another level of health. And this comes from different, I want to say fake news, there is some truth to it, but I'll explain in a minute, about how vegetarian or vegan diets can lower cancer risks, and also different other diseases like heart disease and inflammatory bowel syndrome. So there's a lot of fake news. There is a lot of real news, but there's a lot of fake news about these benefits of a vegetarian or vegan diet. And it definitely varies based on individual genetics, individual lifestyle before vegetarian, vegan nutrition is concerned, and then also how a certain person goes about implementing their vegetarian, vegan lifestyles. So the cancer vegetarian vegan relationship focuses on the fact that fiber, vitamins, minerals, isoflavones, which are found in soybeans, chickpeas, nuts, and a lot of other nuts, and as well carotenoids, which are in carrots, sweet potatoes, broccoli, a lot of legumes, and also tomatoes and red pepper. So these compounds all have nutritional value, and focusing on a diet that is richer in fiber and vitamins and minerals and isoflavones and carotenoids is going to be beneficial than focusing on a diet that does eat meat. However, it is not solely by omitting meat entirely that these benefits don't work just on their own. There is a lot to do with the balance. And I think this is where flexitarian diets, I kind of think from the research that I've done, that is where that balance comes in. So it's not about eating meats all the time, because it is known that having a lot of fatty red meats is heavy on the arteries, on the heart, can cause, and also if you're cooking it every day on the barbecue and you have char, that is carcinogenic, which can increase your risk of cancer. But again, it's all about balance. So with the vegetarian diet, this sort of health aspect about improving your health regarding a myriad of diseases, it's about what vegetarians focus on eating rather than what they are omitting. Hope that makes sense. Moving on. The last little thing I want to touch on with the health aspects of vegetarianism and veganism is the nutrient deficit. If you're eating vegetarian and vegan, you have a smaller intake of protein, so you need to be eating more like tofu, tempeh, edamame. There's different, you know, whole grains, quinoa, that are really beneficial to substitute your protein intake. So that's not so much of an issue. The more of the issue is the actual minerals. So iron, calcium, zinc, vitamin B12, riboflavin, and omega-3. Now, whilst there are substitutes for all of these different nutrient deficiencies, it's actually very complicated in sense of how much of each mineral you're getting per the substitute, because a lot of the substitutes don't have nearly as much as meats and fish of these nutrients. So you really need to be eating a lot more soy, starchy vegetables, legumes, nuts. If you're vegan, it's a lot more difficult because a lot of dairy products contain higher amounts of those nutrient deficiencies. Yeah, this is where it becomes quite complex, detailed, and it needs to be individualized, personalized. So all I will say is that biggest caveat of vegetarian and vegan diets is the nutrient deficiency, and it's all dependent on how individuals integrate that into their own lifestyle. The last aspect of vegetarian veganism, one of the other big reasons why people choose these diets, is because of meat production and packaging that causes a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. Now, there have been lots and lots and lots of studies about different diets. One of the ones that I have used in my research for this episode was one from the UK comparing meat eaters, fish eaters, vegetarians and vegans in the UK. This is from 2014, and very basically it shows that vegetarians and vegans in general are their diet has much lower GHG, greenhouse gas emissions, than meat eater or fish eater or meat and fish eaters. So the issue with this is that economically speaking, in a marketing perspective, this is all about consumer demand. If people are buying lots and lots of meat, there's going to be high demand, which means that the companies who are producing the meat and packaging the meat and distributing the meat all over the world, they are under a lot of pressure to get as much meat out as they can, as quickly as they can, to make maximum profit. And this is where they would start to take shortcuts and use more automation. And those automated machinery is what actually produces the large greenhouse gas emissions. Environmentally speaking, there's also the fact that sort of on the other side of the coin, cows produce naturally a lot of methane. And if we weren't farming cows, there have been different predictive studies done that even if we weren't farming cows and cattle and we did stop eating them completely, they would actually populate enough to maintain a level of greenhouse gas emission. Now, again, this is like a big debate in science, these sort of types of studies, as to where you draw the line, what kind of factors you're looking at specifically, what are your variables that you're isolating, blah, 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 blah. But generally speaking, there's an issue if you produce and package meat to meet consumer demands, and there is an issue if we don't eat meat. So where do we find the balance? A lot of the vegetarian and vegan diets, they take the pressure off the consumer end, so there's not such a consumer demand, which means that companies should be producing less meat, which means they can take more time into making it quality. However, this isn't exactly what the effect has been, because a lot of companies, they have been operating this way for a couple decades, and they, whilst they might not have as much consumer demand anymore, they are still going to use the same machinery, the same methods, because it's cheaper than getting new equipment and putting more detail in. The trick here is that if you do eat meat, like me, then you should be looking to, if the concern is about greenhouse gas emissions and environmental sustainability, then you want to be looking for companies that do actually have ethical practices in terms of also animal rights and humanely killing animals, and also in terms of their manufacturing, packaging, and distribution processes. Now, yes, these companies do exist. A lot of these are sourced at local farmers markets, or if you drive like an hour out of big cities, you can find small butchers in local small towns that have these processes because it's much of a smaller consumer base and they deal with what they have. So it is possible to consider sustainability and be environmentally friendly and also humane to animals while still enjoying the meats that you need and that you love. In terms of the humane argument, humanely killing animals, some may argue that it's not humane at all to kill animals. I see it that everything on this planet lives and dies. As morbid as that may seem to some people, it's a fact. And, you know, it's part of our evolution has been to consume meat. So it's a life cycle. And I don't think that if you're doing it, as I said, if you're doing it in a humane way, I think the actual killing itself it's a part of life. And that's where I'll finish up on that topic. Yeah, that's what we've talked about today. A lot of different details of diets, going from the John Hopkins diet, the keto diet, vegetarian, veganism, all of the different isms associated with that, and a bit more into depth on the vegetarian veganism. So thanks for listening in with me today. I hope you found this entertaining and possibly informative.